There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. Today's episode, though, is given over to the perspectives of one leader and his view of how the world is shaping up. In a swearing-in ceremony at the Élysée Palace almost 7 years ago, Emmanuel Macron became France's youngest president at age 39. Forgive the hackneyed phrase here, but he really had swept to power. He created a whole new party the year before, the Republic on the Move. He got two-thirds of the presidential vote. Later, the party won an absolute majority in the National Assembly. Striding towards the stage to the strains of Beethoven's Ode to Joy, the European Union's anthem, his optimism and the grand scope of his ambitions were on full display in his victory speech. Europe and the world expect us to defend freedom everywhere, he said.
Menacés dans tant d'endroits, ils attendent que nous portions une nouvelle espérance.
They expect us to bring some new hope. But his time in office has also been troubled with challenges at home from the Gilets Jaunes, or yellow vests. French citizens who rose up against fuel tax increases across the country.
Je prends ma part de cette responsabilité. Il a pu m'arriver de vous donner le sentiment que ce n'était pas mon souci.
Try as he might to calm the situation, the protests dragged on and on. The international stage has provided its own challenges. Mr. Macron's Africa policy has fallen apart, with coups in French-speaking nations and French troops asked to leave Mali after years of peacekeeping. And then there's Russia. Weeks before the invasion of Ukraine, he went to Moscow to try to talk Vladimir Putin down.
Monsieur le Président, Vladimir, merci pour votre accueil dans un moment.
After the invasion, he found himself more and more isolated as he tried harder and harder.
Ensemble, ne jamais céder à la tentation, ni de l'humiliation, ni de l'esprit de revanche.
His notion that Russia must not be humiliated didn't win much support. The international community didn't seem to have much appetite for his diplomacy. Now, 2 years on, more challenges await. France's perennially threatening far right is surging again, and Mr. Macron seems to be striking a far more strident note on Mr. Putin and on Europe itself.
So on Monday late afternoon, we went to interview President Emmanuel Macron at his presidential office, that is the Élysée Palace.
Sophie Petter, The Economist's Paris bureau chief, and our deputy editor, Edward Carr, spoke with the French president.
It's a grand former mansion that is right in the center of the capital.
Yeah, what it lacks in Wi-Fi, it makes up for in gilt.
Gilt as in the golden sense of the word.
In the golden sense, yeah. The front road in front of the Élysée is all fenced off, so you go through a gate and a fence and you're accompanied by a gendarme. And then there's the big gravel front before the Élysée, and that's where you see all the world leaders standing on the steps next to Macron. Unfortunately, as mere guests, we're not allowed to walk on the gravel, so we're taken around the side and then into this wonderful front door and hall. And just off there, De Gaulle's desk is on display, and you get a real sense of the grandeur of the French state when you walk in there.
And particularly with De Gaulle's bureau, the desk that he used, which was rather amazing to have been able to go and take a look at that up close before we actually went up to do the interview. But obviously we were there to discuss much more contemporary issues, so we went upstairs to his first floor office. And it was really just days after he'd given this extraordinary speech at the Sorbonne.
De grande transformation, et mon message d'aujourd'hui est simple.
Where he laid out really what he wanted to do for Europe and to reinforce Europe.
Nous devons être lucides sur le fait que notre Europe aujourd'hui est mortelle. Elle peut mourir.
And in which he declared that Europe can die.
So before we get deeply into the conversation that you had, tell me your sort of overall impressions of the time that you spent with President Macron.
Well, I think the first thing that struck both Ed and me was the absolute urgency with which he spoke. He kept saying things like, you know, we've got to do this within months. If we don't do this, things could unravel very quickly.
Les choses peuvent se désagréger très vite.
A civilization can die, he said, with a reference to Paul Valéry, the World War I French writer.
En faisant référence à la formule de Paul Valéry après la Première Guerre mondiale sur le fait que nous savons maintenant que nos civilisations peuvent mourir.
And I think that it was really that, the sense that he is both extremely worried, but also combative. It was apocalyptic. The tone really did knock us both out, I think. And that's despite having sat through the Sorbonne speech a few days earlier. It's the gravity, the darkness that really stood out throughout the entire conversation. And we spoke for an hour and a half.
Edward, what were your thoughts?
Well, I'm used to the idea of Macron thinking big. That's his style. But even by those standards, this was quite striking. I thought the whole conversation was sort of framed by three wars. As Sophie said, the First World War, where Paul Valéry said civilizations might seem permanent, but they can die. The Second World War, where the historian Marc Bloch, right just after the defeat of France, said this happened because elites are complacent. They refuse to look history in the eye.
J'ai pas mieux à dire. Relisez Marc Bloch. C'est ça qu'on voit en Europe.
And then the current war, the war in Ukraine. And here, I think, the prophet was Macron himself, who was warning about the significance of this war and how underprepared Europe was for the future that was being brought in by this war.
It's clear why that is a stark vision of now, but the death of Europe as a civilization, the sort of the starkness about the future, I mean, help me understand that vision.
He was actually quite structured in his answer. I mean, he always is, but this was particularly the case. And he really had three ways of looking at why Europe is facing such a challenging moment in its history. The first was the geopolitical risk.
Nous avons un risque militaire géopolitique. De sécurité.
Obviously, it's to do with Russia, and he's actually turned into quite a hawk on Russia in recent times. But the risk he was talking about was that of Russia acting in all domains, being aggressive in cyber, in disinformation, threatening to use nuclear weapons.
Je dirais économique et technologique. Il n'y a pas de grande puissance.
The second was economic and technological risk. The idea that if Europe doesn't take some pretty big decisions now, it's going to fall behind America, it's going to fall behind China, and it isn't going to be able to guarantee prosperity. And then the third one was democratic risk.
C'est que l'Europe est touchée par cette crise des démocraties. Et nous sommes le continent qui a inventé la démocratie libérale.
He talked about the complacency of elites in the face of the threat of nationalism. He developed that a bit with reference not just to nationalists in France, but across Europe and Brexiteers, in fact, in the UK.
D'une Europe qui est mortelle, qui peut mourir. C'est que je veux faire toucher du doigt à la fois les autres dirigeants européens, mais l'ensemble des concitoyens européens.
And what struck me, Sophie, was that these risks were all fed off each other. One of the reasons that Europe is so threatened by Russia is that Macron is not confident that the United States isn't being distracted by its rivalry with China.
Les risques qui sont les nôtres, celui de perdre la sécurité et de ne pas avoir une défense crédible, celui de perdre la prospérité et d'avoir
And he's not confident that Europe has the prosperity and industry to be able to arm itself. So that leads to that second economic fear, that Europe's just being left behind in key technologies. And then people's anxiety about security and about prosperity is what feeds the extreme politics that he's concerned about. So it's a constellation of all of those three risks that made this such a powerful exposition of his ideas.
Understood, but let's try to tackle this through those three risks and start with the geopolitics. Surely, front of mind must be war in Ukraine.
Yes, I mean, Russia is clearly, in his view, the greatest immediate threat. And he is extremely concerned about not just resisting Russia and Ukraine, but in making sure that Russia can be deterred from making a move on anywhere else.
La Russie ne peut pas gagner en Ukraine. Si la Russie gagne en Ukraine, nous n'aurons plus de sécurité en Europe.
He said to us, if Russia wins in Ukraine, there will be no security in Europe. And he even listed countries, Moldova, Lithuania, Romania, Poland, asking whether their security could then, in those circumstances, be guaranteed. What was interesting was he doubled down on comments about not excluding the idea of sending forces to Ukraine. And this was referring back to comments he made in February at a conference he'd organized with European leaders, NATO leaders, US representatives. And when he was asked in a press conference afterwards whether he would rule out sending troops to Ukraine, he said, I refuse to exclude anything. That was the comment that really created a problem for Germany. Olaf Scholz immediately said that there was no question whatsoever any troops on the ground. The Americans said the same. And it left Macron looking very isolated, apart from, interestingly, leaders of the countries on Europe's eastern flank. But he didn't for a moment suggest that he regretted those. And in fact, said that if Russia breaks through the front lines, boots on the ground, is a question that all Europeans are going to have to ask themselves. And it's time to face up to that.
He remarked how at the beginning of the war, Russia pretended, at least, to observe international law. And it's just cast away all restraints. It's now fighting on every level. It's got hybrid warfare, disinformation. It's arming itself. It's investing in new weapons. And what he sees is an aggressive, dangerous country spreading mayhem, not just in Europe. You have to remember that France has also had to deal with Russia and its influence in Africa, too. This is a man who speaks with the passion of a convert. He thinks that Russia is dangerous and it's going to come for Europe if Europe does not stand up now.
And coming back to the list of risks that sort of framed this whole conversation, the economic and technological risks, what did he have to say about those?
His perception there is that Europe's falling behind in key technologies, particularly renewable energy and artificial intelligence, as well as quantum computing. This is a key moment, he thinks, and if Europe is not present in these technologies now, then it may never catch up. His perception is that the United States has decided that the way to go is not having open markets, is by targeting these technologies, subsidizing them, protecting them. And whether you agree with him or not about that, it's his sense that Europe is now the only place that's really open and thinking about the world. Now, I think that's an exaggeration, but his sense is that Europe has to protect itself too, has to sponsor industries if it's going to have a hope of having a presence in these absolutely key and foundational technologies.
And last from the list, then, the democratic risk that he mentions. How did we learn about that?
Well, I think what Ed said about him urging us to reread Marc Bloch and the book that he published about 1940 and the fall of France to Nazi Germany. And that book was really about the complacency of elites. Rather than doing something about it, fighting, they become resigned and say, well, it might not be so bad. And he made the analogy very specifically with Brexit. People have been getting used to something that's actually been very damaging to the British economy. He talked about Brexit impoverishing the UK, not resolving anything.
Ça, le Brexit a appauvri le Royaume-Uni. Le Brexit n'a rien réglé de l'immigration au Royaume-Uni.
And then he got quite agitated, you know, wake up, he kept saying.
Et donc je dis aux Européens, réveillez-vous, réveillez-vous, c'est des Brexiteurs cachés. Tous les nationalistes en européen, c'est des Brexiteurs cachés.
These are the nationalists in Europe today, and he was referring to Europe as well as France, I think, not just to Marine Le Pen and the threat in France, but he called them hidden Brexiteers, that they are saying one thing about now being more supportive of Europe, but in fact, what they want to do is to destroy it from the inside.
He thinks you either hang separately or you hang together. Europe has to stick together in order to be strong. And if each country does not think about how to bring its resources together to have a real say in a world dominated increasingly by these big blocks of the United States and China, separate European countries can think they're great, but it's not going to work. And so he thinks that nationalists lead to division, weakness, and weakness with an aggressor like Russia on your border ultimately invites conflict.
So that is the stark vision that you promised we would hear about. I mean, what's your take on all of these assertions?
I mean, you know, you can't fault him for ambition, but, you know, Macron is brilliant at sort of putting together the vision. And what he's rather less good at, or has a less good track record at, is building the kind of alliances you need or forging the kind of consensus you need in order to make those visions a reality in some ways. But that is the challenge. You know, he is a leader with only 3 more years left in office this time round, at least. And he's up against a lot of people who find his manner difficult, too abrasive, that he throws out ideas. So I think really what you're looking at is extraordinary vision, soaring ambition, but then, you know, what next? How to actually make any of this a reality?
Macron's critics will say this is the Jupiterian French president just pontificating as usual, that it's, you know, actually plans to subsidize and help French national champions wrapped up in a European flag, and that he's really campaigning against Marine Le Pen by doing down nationalists. It would be great if that were true, because that would mean that we didn't have to worry about the bleak picture he paints. But I don't think it is true. I think he's offering something far more substantial and thought out and relevant, and something that, in broad terms, I think is right. Russia is dangerous. America does have to think about China. And China really is getting very far ahead in key technologies. And that poses a massive threat to Europe, and Europe really isn't facing up to it.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
So what to do then with this vision? What was Mr. Macron saying about how to navigate these various risks? Let's start with the geopolitics then.
Well, I think it starts with Europe taking responsibility for its own defense. It can no longer rely on the United States. That means a big increase and redesign of European defense. It also may ultimately involve France extending its nuclear guarantee to the rest of Europe in an explicit way. That would be quite an extraordinary change in the defense structure of Europe, because it would be happening outside NATO. And I think this is the thing where I have sort of biggest problem with his solution, which is there's a real danger that by operating outside NATO, which is where the United States has its formal role, you end up driving the United States out of Europe. Now, that's all very well if what replaces it is a redoubled, reinforced new European structure that's able to take up that position. But I don't think that's credible yet. And there's a real danger that what emerges is an overall system of European defense that's less credible. So that's my big concern. The other thing is this nuclear idea. France's nuclear force is strategic. It's these big city-destroying bombs. Russia has lots of tactical nuclear weapons, and in its nuclear threats in Ukraine, many people have speculated about a sort of escalation that involves the use of tactical nuclear weapons rather than strategic weapons. Well, that creates bumps and gaps in the response one has to Russia. Russia might feel that it can use a tactical nuke, because actually France won't want to go straight to a Moscow-destroying strategic weapon. So that creates uncertainties too. He insists that these things can take place alongside NATO. As an Atlanticist, I worry that actually they end up undermining NATO, driving America out and leaving Europe more vulnerable.
One of the things that I found really interesting about the way he discussed the idea of building what he called a common European defence framework is that what he's doing just really breaks with the traditional French thinking, which is about European Union defence. When they talk about building up European defence, it's about doing it within the EU structures. And what Macron's talking about and what he's wanting to do and the conversations he wants to start having in July when Britain hosts a summit with all European countries is to do things, further cooperate, but with the UK, with Norway, with other countries that have a military capability but are not in the EU. And that's really quite new.
But as regards Mr. Macron's view on the war in Ukraine, he started by trying to play a peacemaker, a statesman, in a way that he came in for real criticism for. How does he defend his position then and now?
Well, overtly, he says that his position hasn't changed, that it's Russia that's really changed. I think far more important than his attempts to try and prevent a war, which were based on a particular interpretation of French intelligence, but far more important than that is his position now. And he's now taking a very hawkish view of Russia. And it's one that you can see Italy, Germany, Spain, other countries are not yet willing to sign up to. And for me, the drama in this is, can he bring those countries round to his point of view? And the fact that he had a different approach at the beginning of the war is a debating point, but it's not a substantial point. The substantial point is his analysis of Russia now convincing? And I think it is.
I think that's right. And I was on that trip with him at the time he went to go and see Putin, just literally, it was weeks before the invasion. I think Macron also at the time wanted to have it put on the record for the history books that the West could never say we didn't try and stop him and do absolutely everything. And that is why he thought he had to go as well. But France also, you know, in recent months, has become the target of really systematic disinformation campaigns. I remember the story about bedbugs in Paris. Well, that was massively turbocharged by Russian troll farms. These are the sorts of things that are going on all the time in France. And this is the Russia they're dealing with. And it's that that's really changed Macron's approach.
And the bedbug story, don't forget, was the single French story that had the biggest effect in Britain the whole of last year.
I haven't been to France since. Getting away from the defence question, though, and onto the other risks, specifically the technology and the policy around that, what's his take on the fix for technological risks?
So it won't surprise you to know that a large amount of it consists of subsidies and protection, but it's much more interesting than that. For a start, he wants to redouble investment in research and development, which is lower than it is in China and the US. Then he wants to create a proper single market. That means liberalizing capital markets so you can finance R&D in the private sector. It means deregulation and simplification of industries so that companies find it easier to act. You have to accept in a single market that companies get good by specializing. Specializing requires scale. Some countries will lose out, some countries will gain, but Europe as a whole will be better off. I guess my worry is that when it comes to it, everyone agrees on the extra subsidies and the protection, but they don't agree on the liberalization. And so you end up with an overall less efficient market, even though that's not his aim. But if you do get the liberalization and much more research and development and better financing of innovation, it could make a difference.
And just to finish up then, the democratic risk, the hidden Brexiteers, the dangerous populists. Sophie, what were the solutions put forward to solve that problem?
Well, I think, you know, they were summed up by one of the lines that he used, and he said, politics isn't about reading polls, it's a fight, it's about ideas, it's about convictions.
Les gens regardent les sondages, mais les sondages font pas la politique. C'est votre capacité à bouger les choses qu'il a fait. Et donc tout le monde dit,
he's convinced that you cannot be resigned to nationalists taking over. He's facing a really difficult situation in France. If you look at opinion polls at the moment, they do suggest two things. One is that Marine Le Pen's national rally will come top by a very big margin at elections to the European Parliament in June. And the second one, and it's a way off now, but in 2027, when Macron can't run again for a third term, he's constitutionally barred from being president for more than two consecutive terms, The polls suggest that, you know, there is a risk that Marine Le Pen might be elected. Now, that, I think, is where Macron is trying to convey the message that the only way to do this is to keep fighting.
Mais en ayant l'audace, en ne pensant pas que c'est une fatalité, moi, ce qui me tue, c'est en France comme en Europe, l'esprit de défaite.
He had this extraordinary line. He said, what kills me in France is the spirit of defeat.
La politique, c'est Eros contre Thanatos. C'est ça, la politique. Tout le reste, après, on met des arguments.
His party will struggle. At the moment, the centre ground in France is going to find it very difficult to outlive Emmanuel Macron's presidency because he's not built his party up into a well-structured organisation that is ready to carry that battle forward. And he hasn't yet found a successor of the calibre that would enable him to hand over that struggle in a way that's reassuring. But one thing was very clear from the sort of energetic way in which he was discussing nationalism is not just that it's a threat and it's a question of dismantling their lies, but also, you know, you've just got to keep fighting.
At the mention of domestic politics, I mean, we took a moment to stand back and take an assessment of the vision itself. Let's do the same now and make an assessment of the fixes. And let me start then with the question that is this actually a grandiose stump speech? Is this just electioneering on his part and it happens to have a global scope to it?
No, I don't think that's what he intends at all. There may be some politics kind of layered on at the end. But I think he's serious. He means what he says. For me, the big problem here is that Europe is a complicated place of 27 governments and a commission and institutions who are very, very hard to corral. They come from different political persuasions. Some are worried about populists at home. Some are populists. Some are worried about elections. Getting them all pointing in the same way is very, very hard. The key to that is France and Germany being absolutely in agreement. But the truth is that Macron, Olaf Scholz, the Chancellor of Germany, don't get on. Relations are not good. They are completely different in their style and approach to politics. That's my sense.
I think that's right. And the Franco-German relationship is absolutely crucial. The starting point between those two countries is always that they have differences on almost everything, whether it's nuclear power or fiscal rules. But having said that, I think that one of the things that's been interesting, really over the last year, I would say, is that perhaps precisely because Macron finds it so difficult to work with the current German Chancellor Scholz, that he has sort of been trying to reach out to other countries, notably Poland, where Donald Tusk is now in charge after Poland's nationalist moment. That's also the case with a number of other Central European countries, which France traditionally was extremely dismissive of, hardly regarded them as sort of proper, serious, grown-up countries. And there was this speech he made in Bratislava a year ago in which he almost apologized for some of his predecessors' attitudes towards Central and Eastern Europe.
So broadly, you agree with the scope, the graveness of the task ahead as he lays it out, even with many of the prescriptions that he lays out. But there are many reasons from structural to personal why it's not likely he gets it all accomplished. How do we view this as anything other than the death knell he says it is?
Because I think if Europe is going to find a way through this, then it starts by articulating the problems. Unless someone articulates the problems and the challenges facing Europe as clearly and distinctly as he has, nothing at all is going to happen. So I think that's a first step, and he deserves credit for that. My only concern about, you know, normally one would say, well, you know, he asks for a pound and he gets 50 pence. He gets some of what he wants. That's progress. My only concern is that in one aspect of this, and that's a security one, driving away America and putting a bit of Europe back does not make Europe safer. It makes it less well off. So it's not the case that in everything, getting a bit of what you ask for is better than getting nothing at all. But I think Macron deserves credit. Too much of Europe is kind of sleepwalking. I think he's basically right about the complacency. Europe is not performing economically. It has got an enemy on its flank and it's not responding. And too many people are just willing to bury their heads in the sand, expect America to deal with all their problems, not face up to the future. And the one thing you have to give Macron credit for is looking history in the eye.
Sophie, Edward, thank you both very much for your time.
Thanks very much, Jason.
Thanks, Jason.
you can read the full transcript of our interview with Mr. Macron, as well as our own analysis of its aims and scope, on our website, economist.com. That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. The show's editors are Chris Impey and Jack Gill. Our deputy editor is John Joe Devlin, and our sound designer is Will Rowe. Our senior producers are Rory Galloway and Sarah Larniuk. Our senior creative producer is William Warren. Our producers are Maggie Kadifa and Benji Guy, and our assistant producer is Henrietta McFarlane. We'll all see you back here tomorrow for the Weekend Intelligence.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.